To Boston University's World of Ideas, I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we present the second in a series of excerpts taken from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, held this spring at Boston University and sponsored by the Partisan Review. Over the course of the summer, we'll broadcast other excerpts from the conference, which featured a number of notable speakers on a wide range of topics. Tonight's topic is the ascendance of science and technology. We'll hear first from inventor and entrepreneur Raymond Kurzweil. Later on, we'll hear from Dr. Gerald Weissman of New York University's School of Medicine. Raymond Kurzweil has founded, built, and sold four successful high-technology companies, all of which use artificial intelligence and pattern recognition. His pioneering work ranges from optical character recognition to flatbed scanning to computer-generated music. His latest firm develops genetic algorithms and neural nets to make stock market decisions. Raymond Kurzweil.
And I'd like to share with you some thoughts that I've been developing for a few decades about how technology is evolving. This emerged from my own interest as an inventor. I quickly realized that my inventions had to make sense when I finished the project, not when I began the project, and that the world invariably was a different place 3 or 4 years later. So I became an ardent student of technology trends and began to develop models, ultimately some mathematical models, for how technology in different areas evolve. And that interest took on a life of its own. So I began to develop scenarios built from these models that actually allowed me to invent with the resources of the future, because if we have some idea of what communications, computation, life sciences, the size of technology, the cost-effectiveness of technology will be 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we can build scenarios which essentially invent with the technologies of the future. And perhaps the most startling or important trend that I've become acutely aware of is that the pace of progress itself, what I call the paradigm shift rate, is itself accelerating. Now, if I just say that, people are very quick to agree to that, but very few people really internalize the profound implications of it. It means that the last 30 years is not a good guide to the next 30 years. We're doubling the paradigm shift rate approximately every decade. So the last century, which saw quite a bit of profound change, was equivalent to about 20 years of progress at today's rate of progress, because we've been speeding up to this point. And we'll make 20 years of progress at today's rate of progress equivalent to the last century in the next 14 years. The 21st century, because of the explosive power of exponential growth, will be equivalent to 20,000 years of progress at today's rate of progress, which is far greater than all of recorded history. Exponential trends start out slow. It looks like nothing's happening at all. Then suddenly it takes off. Then there's a veritable explosion as you reach what I call the knee of the curve. And we're now achieving that knee of the curve in a lot of different areas, and we'll hear a lot more from our other panelists about the era we're now embarking on in terms of the intersection of biology and information science. As we understand the information processes underlying life and disease, we're going to be able to manipulate those with quite profound effects. And there's obviously a lot of ethical concerns that come up. I think we'll get into that in the discussion, but I want to just share with you quickly some of the trends which I've been exploring. And because of the limited time, I can't really discuss these in great detail, so I won't describe these charts in detail. They are on my website, kurzweilai.net. This shows you the amount of time it took for these different technologies to be adopted by a quarter of the U.S. population. So electricity and the telephone took decades. The World Wide Web was adopted in just a few years' time. It's part of that overall acceleration. I have many different charts like this. The whole phenomena of technological evolution is a continuation of the biological evolution that led to the technology creating species in the first place. Evolution works by indirection. It creates some new products, and those products then create the next stage. So evolution works indirectly through those products. So primitive DNA was created, then the DNA was able to record and provide an information backbone to run experiments. So the first paradigm shift took billions of years, and then with the advent of DNA, the Cambrian explosion only took a few tens of millions of years, and biological evolution kept accelerating. Homo sapiens evolved in only a few 100,000 years, and then technology continued, again, indirectly using one of its products, Homo sapiens, combination of cognitive skill and an opposable thumb to manipulate our environment, and ushered in another evolutionary process, that of human-directed technology and cultural evolution. And there, the first steps took tens of thousands of years, a speed up over biological evolution, stone tools, language, the most important of our technologies, which enables us to have a species-wide shared knowledge base that is itself growing exponentially. 1,000 years ago, a paradigm shift like the printing press took 100 years, and we've accelerated ever since. And if you put these, this is a double exponential chart, technological evolution continues very much in a straight line from biological evolution on this double exponential chart. Now, people look at the underlying data and they say, well, this isn't really right. You know, the Cambrian explosion didn't take 10 million years. It took 25 million years. And so we start moving the points around. Because of the nature of exponential chart, it's still a straight line. The underlying phenomena is very powerful. Now, Moore's law is a paradigm that people have heard of, and it reflects the exponential growth of computers, and you only have to open up your morning paper to see that this week's computers are far more powerful and less expensive and smaller than last week's. And there's been some concern, well, we're going to run out of space. Exponential trends run out of steam eventually, and that's true. Within 12 years, approximately, the key features of a transistor will only be a few atoms in width, and we won't be able to shrink them anymore. So is that going to be the end of Moore's law? Well, the answer is yes. That'll be the end of Moore's law of that particular paradigm, but it's not going to be the end of the exponential growth of computing. And to get some insight into that, I put here 49 famous computers on. This is, again, an exponential chart, not a linear chart. So as you go up the chart, it represents multiplying computer power by a factor, in this case, of 100. So at the lower left, there's the electromechanical calculators that were used in the 1890 American census using these punch cards. Those machines were subsequently shipped to the Florida Election Commission. Then 1942, relays-based computer built out of old telephone relays that Alan Turing and his colleagues used to crack the Nazi Enigma code, which Churchill had to use very carefully because he didn't want to give away the fact that he had cracked the code. So sometimes he didn't use the information, or they would try to get some other way of being able to say that they got the information. So if they knew that some ships were coming, they would send a plane over. The Germans would see the plane, and they figured the reason that the English knew that their ships were there is because they were spotted, but actually the English had cracked the code. 1952, vacuum tubes came in. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower. They were shrinking vacuum tubes to make them smaller, to be able to fit more of them into a computer and make the computers more cost-effective. They finally couldn't shrink them anymore and keep the vacuum. And people thought, well, that's going to be the end of the exponential growth of computing. Well, a whole different paradigm came along, transistors, which are not small tubes. It's a whole different approach, and kept the exponential growth going. So the integrated circuits is the fifth paradigm, not the first one, to provide exponential growth to computing. And when that runs out of steam, we'll go to the sixth paradigm, which is to go into the third dimension. Chips are very dense, but they're flat. They're two-dimensional. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brain is three-dimensional. And even though our brain uses a very cumbersome, slow form of information processing, our interneuronal connections compute at about 200 calculations per second, that's 10 million times slower than our electronic circuits today, the brain gets its tremendous power because it's organized massively parallelly in three dimensions. And there have been at least 20 different projects that are making very significant progress in developing three-dimensional circuits. Some use fallouts from biological technologies, such as DNA computers. My favorite is carbon nanotubes, which is, again, going back to carbon, but a little bit organized a little bit differently than the carbon of life. These are hexagonal arrays of carbon atoms that can compute in three dimensions. And a one-inch cube of nanotube circuitry would be a million times more powerful than the capacity of the human brain. And just in the last year, there's been tremendous progress made in that area. Another interesting thing is that you'll notice that's not a straight line. A straight line on an exponential chart represents exponential growth. And you'll notice that's an exponential. We actually have exponential growth in the rate of exponential growth. It took us 3 years to double the price performance of computing at the beginning of the 20th century, 2 years in the middle. We're now doubling the price performance of computing every 1 year. Now, in the interest of time, I'm just going to show you very quickly just how pervasive this phenomena of the exponential growth of particularly information-based technologies is. It's not just computers. It's many different phenomena. For example, biological technology, which you'll hear about more from our other panelists, but the Genome Project was not a mainstream project 15 years ago. Mainstream critics said, there's no way you're going to be able to sequence the genome in 15 years. We just spent a year, we're only able to sequence 1/10,000th of the genome. How are we going to finish it in 15 years? Okay, it'll speed up a little bit, but not by enough. But indeed, we doubled the price performance of base pair sequencing every year. Went from $12 per base pair in 1990 to a penny in 2000. It's now about 0.1%, enabling most of the project to be finished in the last year of the project. Magnetic data storage, that's not Moore's law. That's a different phenomenon. An interesting thing I would point out on this chart, each one of these black dots represents a project or a product. And so each dot represents a human story, a drama of venture capital, IPOs, competition, bankruptcies. You'd think, therefore, that the trend would be very erratic. Maybe the general trend would be there, but it wouldn't make such a smooth, predictable curve. It's remarkable just how predictable these curves are. Communications, just as profound as computation. There's 20 different ways to look at it. This is ISP cost performance. But all of these trends move in exponential with exponential growth. And if you get enough data, as you can see on this chart, you can actually see the cascade of S-curves. That's how technology evolves. A particular approach, one technology, a paradigm, starts out slowly, explodes exponentially, but then reaches its limits. But then another paradigm takes over and continues the exponential growth. So it keeps the exponential growth going when a particular paradigm hits its asymptote is innovation, paradigm shift. You can see that here again, a little bit smaller ripples, but that's what's causing the ripples as different technologies kick in. Here's the internet. In the book I wrote in the 1980s, I predicted that the internet would be a big deal and a ubiquitous phenomenon by the mid-1990s. Now, in the mid-1980s, we went from 20,000 nodes to 40,000 in 1 year and then doubled it to 80,000. But that's a very small number. Only a few thousand scientists were using it. Nobody had heard of the internet. But you could see that by the mid-1990s, it would reach 20 million and then double to 40 million and to 80 million, and then it would be on people's radar screen. Here's the same chart on a linear graph rather than exponential. This is how we experience technology. We don't experience it in the exponential domain. We live in a linear world. So most people's perception, the internet just blew out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. But if you looked at the exponential trend, you could see it coming. Another very important trend is miniaturization. This is the decrease in transistor size, which is a reflection of Moore's law. But it's also true of mechanical devices. We're now at the stage of technology called MEMS, microelectronic mechanical systems, which is using the same technology that we use to build integrated circuits to actually build tiny little machines, gears, motors, and building tiny little robots. There's actually an intersection of this technology, MEMS, with electronics and biology. There are 5 major conferences on something called BioMEMS, which are devices which are the size of blood cells, which will actually go inside the bloodstream for medical purposes, built using this type of technology. Not quite nanotechnology yet. These are a little bit bigger than the multi-nanometer scale. One device, for example, tiny little device where you put pancreatic islet cells in, there's little pores that are 7 nanometers in size, lets the insulin out, but it blocks the antibodies, which are a little bit bigger than the insulin molecules. Lets oxygen in to feed the pancreatic islet cells. And this has actually cured type 1 diabetes in rats, and there's no reason why the same methodology wouldn't work in humans. And there are dozens of ideas like that, which you will see come to fruition in the years ahead. Just to comment on ethics, which is interesting, there's a lot of controversy raised by certain biological technologies, although I don't think they're actually going to slow them down. In my mind, they're really kind of just stones in a stream. The progress flows around them. The most controversial technology, which is stem cell research, first of all, that's continuing, but the controversy has actually accelerated ideas to convert one type of cell into another without having to use an egg cell, which is actually a more practical approach anyway because we don't have that many egg cells. I mean, what's the difference between a skin cell and a heart cell or a neuron? They all have the entire genetic code. There are certain protein signaling factors that tell the cell I'm a skin cell and tells which ones of the genes to express. We're learning, we're at the beginning of this process, but we're beginning to learn how to manipulate those protein signaling factors. And there were some recent experiments which actually successfully converted one type of cell into another without using an egg cell. So the progress continues, but there is controversy about biological manipulation because some people feel we're embarking on sacred ground and that our biology is part of our sacred definition as humans. But interestingly, there's no controversy when it comes to merging our biological bodies and brains with non-biological technology. There's 12 different neural implants. Just 2 weeks ago, the FDA approved a neural implant for Parkinson's disease, which actually alleviates the symptoms of that disease. And it's an implant that actually performs the same functions as the corpus of cells that are destroyed by that disease and actually communicates with the other biological neurons. It's inserted in a Parkinson's patient and actually significantly suppresses the symptoms of that disease. There's cochlear implants. My friend went profoundly deaf 15 years ago. He got a cochlear implant. I can now talk to him on the phone. He's getting it upgraded this year to a new version that has 1,000 points of auditory frequency discrimination, so he'll be able to hear music again. He's been complaining he's had the same tunes going in his head for 15 years, and he's looking forward to hearing some new music. And there's, as I mentioned, 4 conferences with dozens of ideas to put mechanical electronic devices inside our bloodstream. We have devices that go through our gastrointestinal system, inside our brains, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no controversy about that, which is interesting. I do see that's another major trend we're going to be merging with our technology. Here is that trend I showed you before on computing, now going through the 20th and 21st century. So there's the 49 computers through the 20th century, exponential growth of the rate of exponential growth. Right now we're $1,000 of computation is about equal to a mouse brain. By 2020 it'll equal the 20 billion million calculations per second. That is a relatively high estimate of the human brain. When my last book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, came out 3 years ago, there was more controversy as to whether or not we would achieve the hardware capacity to emulate the human brain. I think far fewer people today would question that. There's still an issue in some people's mind whether we'll have the software. Okay, we'll have these very fast computers, but that isn't going to give us human intelligence. We need to have the software of human intelligence. And as really an existence proof that we will have the software, there's a grand project underway that you can think of as analogous to the Genome Project to reverse engineer the human brain. Now, we haven't fully reverse engineered the genome. We have most of the raw data. We need to understand it. The whole proteome project is to understand how the genome expresses itself in protein. And we're at an even earlier stage with the brain, but we're much further along than people realize. Brain scanning is growing exponentially in speed, resolution, price, performance. The amount of knowledge we have of the brain is growing exponentially. I don't have time to explain this chart, but this is actually a reverse engineered model or diagram of it, of the human auditory system done by a scientist, Lloyd Watts, who's pulled information together from dozens of other neurobiologists. Each one of these rectangles represents an actual region of the brain. Now, the brain is not one big neural net. It's wrong to think of the brain as one organ. It'd be like thinking of the body as one organ. The body has different regions. They work differently. They have different principles of operation. Similarly, the brain is really hundreds of different regions. Each one has different neurons, different ways of connecting the neurons together, different principles of operation. But he actually has a very detailed mathematical model, which he's implemented in software, of about 15 regions of the human auditory system, how it represents information, how that information is transformed, how it communicates to other regions. He's built that and then applied psychoacoustic tests to his model, compared it to the same tests on human hearing. Gets very similar results. The system is able, for example, just like people, to pick out a voice in a particular localized area of space, connecting it to speech recognition. The device can now recognize voices despite background noises, which used to trick speech recognition. So we're much further along than people realize in reverse engineering the human brain. It's a conservative scenario to say that within 25 years we will have a detailed model of the human brain. And it brings up the issue of just how complex is the human brain. It's not simple. It's not one big neural net with one sort of simple formula. It is a very complex organ, but the complexity is not beyond what we're able to handle with our technology even today. The brain is specified by a genome of only 12 million bytes. The genome is 6 billion bits, that's 800 million bytes, but this replete with redundancies. This one sequence called ALU is repeated 300,000 times. If you just compress the genome based on its redundancies with a lossless compression, you get about 30 to 1 compression, which reduces the genome to 23 million bytes of information. Half of that, or about 12 million bytes, specifies the brain. That's less than Microsoft Word. But the brain itself has millions of times more information than that. So how could that be? How could the brain have thousands of trillions of bytes of information in it when it's specified by only 12 million bytes? The answer is not hard to understand. The genome specifies certain processes. It'll specify that in a certain region, the internal connections follow a certain type of pattern, there's certain constraints, but within that, the wiring is random. And then as the brain encounters its environment, it self-organizes to reflect knowledge of its environment, and over time, that knowledge becomes quite meaningful. And that then accounts for this sort of expansion of the brain's knowledge by a factor of several million. I only have a few minutes left, but this exponential growth of technology reflects itself in the exponential growth of our economy. This is the economy over the last century. The most pervasive thing you see is profound exponential growth. Recessions, the Great Depression, which a lot of focus is on when they happen, are relatively small perturbations underlying that underlying exponential growth. And what's interesting is that when you have a recession, even the Great Depression, the economy snaps back to where it would have been had that recession or depression never occurred in the first place. Private manufacturing productivity is growing exponentially. That's clearly due to technology. Here's e-commerce growing exponentially. You don't see any reflection of the manic depressive cycle of Wall Street. The underlying phenomena is exponential growth. Human knowledge is growing exponentially. This is one reflection of many U.S. patents. Intellectual property, education expenditures. In terms of scenarios, by the end of this decade, we won't be carrying around these rectangular boxes. We'll be writing images directly to our retina from our eyeglasses and contact lenses, so we'll have full immersion, visual, auditory, virtual reality. So a conference like this, we'll be able to see each other and be together even if we're not geographically proximate. Electronics will be so tiny, they'll be in our clothing, in our environment, in our eyeglasses. We'll have a very high bandwidth connection to the internet at all times. By 2029, this technology will go inside our bodies and brains. These little devices going in the bloodstream, which are already on the drawing boards today and are actually working today in animals, will be in full swing, certainly well before this, augmenting our immune system, but also augmenting our human intelligence. So you want to be in real reality, the nanobots that are traveling in the capillaries of your brain sit there and do nothing. You want to be in virtual reality, the nanobots shut down the signals coming from your real senses, replace them with the signals your brain would be receiving if you were in the virtual environment. Then your brain feels like it's in the virtual environment. And now you can have full immersion virtual reality incorporating all of the senses. So you can have any kind of experience with anyone in these virtual environments. Virtual environments could be emulations of earthly environments or creations of environments that don't exist on Earth. People will beam their whole flow of sensory experiences out on the internet the way people beam their images from their video cams today. You'll be able to plug in and experience what it's like to be someone else. I love the plot concept of being John Malkovich. These can include the neurological correlates of our emotions. But most importantly, we'll be able to expand human intelligence. Right now, we're limited to a mere 100 trillion connections, and I don't know about you, but I find that very limiting. Not a day goes by where I don't get some really compelling book that I want to read and hear about 10 websites I want to visit and conferences I want to go to, and our bandwidth is just very limited, we'll ultimately be able to expand those 100 trillion connections to 200 trillion or 100 trillion times 1,000 and also have intimate connection to non-biological forms of intelligence. Keep in mind that biological intelligence is fixed. Today we have 10 to the 26th power calculations per second in the human race. And 50 years from now, biological intelligence on Earth will still be 10 to the 26th power. Today, non-biological intelligence is about 1 million times less powerful than biological. So it appears that biological intelligence still dominates. But non-biological intelligence is growing exponentially. The crossover point is in the 2020s. To get out to 2040, 2045, 2050, non-biological intelligence will be trillions of times more powerful than biological intelligence. But it's not an alien invasion of intelligent machines coming from over the horizon to compete with us. It's emerging from within our civilization and literally will be inside our bodies and brains. It's not going to be a clear distinction between computers and humans. We think of sometimes when I talk about this, people think, well, I don't want to merge with a machine, because they think of machines as something that is much more brittle, much less subtle, much less soft and cuddly than humans. But that's technology of the past, where machines were millions of times simpler than humans. In the future, technology will have the same subtlety and suppleness as our biological technology, and it will be used to enhance our biological capacity. People say, well, you know, exponential trends run out of steam, rabbits in Australia, there's no way this can go on forever. It'll hit a wall and it won't continue to expand forever. But the key point is that the resources needed for computation, communication, for knowledge, for all the things I've been talking about, are virtually zero. Like, there have been theoretical examinations of this, the amount of matter and energy you need to do communications and computation. It's virtually zero. It's not quite zero, but we have more than enough material here on Earth to keep these trends going well through the 21st century. And I'll just, last slide, which is a good introduction to the next speaker. Another one of these exponential trends is human life expectancy. In the 18th century, every year we added a few days to human life expectancy. In the 19th century, every year we added a few weeks. We're now adding over 100 days per year to human life expectancy from all of the revolutions of rational drug design, therapeutic cloning of cells and tissues, and genomics and proteomics, which are in their early stages. And the next 10 years is going to be a real golden age of biotechnology. Really, nanotechnology, some of these other things will come later in terms of really hitting their stride. Many observers, including myself, believe that within 10 years we'll be adding more than a year every year to human life expectancy. So as you go forward a year, human life expectancy will move out away from us. So if you can hang in there for another 10 years, we may actually get to experience the remarkable century ahead. And I think that's a good introduction to our next speaker. Thank you.
Raymond Kurzweil. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. And you're listening to excerpts from the Partisan Review Conference on Our Country, Our Culture, 1952 to 2002. Tonight's topic is the ascendance of science and technology. Next, we hear from Dr. Gerald Weissman, professor of medicine and director of New York University's Biotechnology Study Center. Dr. Weissman is internationally known as the co-discoverer of liposomes. He's also an author of 6 volumes of collected essays on cultural history. Dr. Weissman.
The big event in 1952, at the time that the New York intellectuals of the arts were deciding how they felt about their country, was the visit of a non-intellectual Middle Western scientist to the intellectual capital of crystallography, Cambridge. And it was Jim Watson going to meet Francis Crick and work with him in Cambridge. Looking at Wilkins and Franklin's X-ray data, they came up with the model of DNA, published in April 26, 1953, within the year that the paradigm shift of this conference took place. Something really important did take place, namely the description of the phosphate groups of DNA were on the outside and that the helix looked like this. In the 50 years thereafter, there have been two other major applications of this that have a significant impact, I should have thought, and you've just heard about what the future may bring, on human life on Earth. The first one occurred not in the United States, but in Scotland in the sheep, and it was a cloning of Dolly, and that's a reproductive cloning by Ian Wilmot. And Dolly's shown up there. It's significant that this was not done in the United States because of the problem that I show in the bottom slide. It is this reductionist, materialist view of science in the presence of the modern world that I'd like to address now, and I'd like to give the historical background for suggesting that the reductionist revolution that you heard that is growing experientially has a historic base. And the historic base will be immediately obvious to those people interested in Western culture. Well, speed matters was the motto of Celera Genomics, Craig Venter's company. In 87, the Department of Energy announced that the Human Genome Project would include five labs, and this is done under the direction and with the enthusiastic support of Jim Watson, who'd gotten the Department of Energy into this because they had all this computing capacity and all these labs and nothing much was going on in them that involved humans. So machinery was available, the labs were available, and they estimated, according to the National Research Council, that it would take 3 billion years and be finished in 2003. In 1988, Jim Watson took over the effort, combined with the National Institutes of Health and international consortiums, including Cambridge, France, and Tokyo. And some conflict occurred. Jim Watson is a rather outspoken chap, as he wanted to admit in his book, The Double Helix, and offended some of the people by being a bit reductionist in his views. Francis Collins, who was more spiritual, took over. And at the time, the estimates would be that it would take $200 million per year, and it would end in 2003. Collins, in fact, complained that he was not being given enough money to do this. The machines that Collins eventually depended on were done by another branch of Celera's business arrangement named Aplera. And in 1998, Venter founded Celera Genomics, and he estimated it would take $250 million, and he'd be finished in 2001. Well, I showed you the picture. In 2000, the simultaneous announcement of the Human Genome Project and of Celera Genomics, and the map was pretty much done, January 2001, joint, if disparate, and conflicting publications. Take-home message. Time and cost, public, 14 years, $2 billion. Private, 2 years, $250 million. Speed matters in the Human Genome Project was fulfilled. Was there ever anything like this? This is a remarkable phenomenon in which a private group of entrepreneurs managed to beat out a huge public arrangement in which the finest scientists of his day, like Jim Watson, was in charge. Well, actually, there is a precedent. It mattered in the Enlightenment. In 1657, Colbert asked the Académie des Sciences to pair plates of machinery used in the arts and sciences and put in the great Réaumur in charge. He was the man who not only invented the thermometer, was a great mathematician. He dominated the sciences of his day. In 1747, 90 years later, Diderot and the Abbé de Guadamal signed the first contract for an encyclopedia with a commercial publisher. And with about 100 or so subscribers, pretty much the way Audubon did the Birds of America, going around doing private enterprise, selling these folios to nobility and others, they decided to put together the Société des gens de lettres and publish an encyclopedia based on the British Chambers Encyclopedia, but also having plates. Well, in 1751, the first volume of Diderot's Encyclopédie was sent to private subscribers, and it was announced that plates would happen. 1759 was important in the project of the encyclopedia, the first because not one Academy fascicle of plates or prints had ever been published. Diderot and his crew was busy making all these plates at the time. There was a huge hearing to see whether Diderot was copying some of the plates that the Academy had had and vice versa, pretty much the kind of conflict we had in the Human Genome Project. But sure enough, in 1761, 62, it happened to be the first week of January, simultaneous publication of Diderot's and the Academy's first volumes of plates. Okay, elapsed time, public 105 years, private, 4 years text, 15 years plates. Reductive private enterprise triumphed over general ideas. Dolly. The main problem that our country, and I mean the United States, and our culture, I mean experimental biological science, has is religious objection to the idea that you can do therapeutic cloning, or that there's a significant difference between protoplasm and silicon. Matter is matter, as was first announced several centuries ago. And it turns out that we now have very unlikely allies against cloning. The fans of nature, the eco-sentimentalists like Bill McKibben, and the fans of natural law like John Horgan, who interviewed scientists who said there must be some natural theological limit to what any individual scientist can do, made headlines in the New York Times saying unlikely allies against cloning. The changes engendered by genetic engineering could force us to reconsider liberalism's faith in the onward march of science. This was made clear last week when a broad coalition of environmentalists, feminists, and other progressives released an open letter urging the Senate to ban reproductive cloning and to place a moratorium on therapeutic cloning, which, of course, is now available in most parts of the enlightened West. At one such rally of environmentalists against sports utility vehicles last spring, a minister held a sign that read, "What would Jesus drive?" Now, it turns out that this is not unique in American culture. This, too, had a precedent, very much as the Genome Project had a precedent in the Enlightenment. It wasn't until 1954 that in my state and city, the doctors were permitted to dissect human bodies. And Harper has appropriately said, science may prove ever so clearly that there's nothing there but carbon and oxygen and lime, which I believe. But all this can never eradicate the sentiment we're considering. It enters too deeply in our laws of thinking, our laws of speech, our most interior moral and religious emotions. And this was the sentiment of most people in the human sciences in the middle of the 19th century, and is obviously still held today. Now, it turns out that human dissection was legalized in New York State, a bill called the Bone Bill, passed in 1854, which finally recognized that New York State could do what was available to Vesalius in Brussels in 1543. So Manhattan finally caught up. And it was done at the behest of John William Draper, the founder and dean of my medical school, who came across with a rather interesting observation and then wrote a very important book in the 19th century. It's called "The History of Science is Not a Mere Record of Isolated Discoveries. It is a narrative of the conflict of two contending powers, the expansive force of the human intellect on one side and the compression arising from traditional faith and human interests on the other. As large a number of persons now live to 70 years as lived to 40, 300 years ago," he's referring to Geneva at the time of the Reformation, "mean longevity in 1840 was 40.7 years. And as I teach my students, it's easy to remember. 1840, life expectancy 40. 1980, life expectancy getting to be 80. He wrote a very important book called "The History of Conflict Between Religion and Science" that was in the forefront of free thought for a good part of the century. But Draper did something else. He and Samuel F.B. Morse, Samuel F.B. Morse was professor of fine arts, and John William Draper, the professor of chemistry at NYU, produced the first American daguerreotypes. The two images upper right and in the middle, there's a conflict about them, which is the oldest surviving daguerreotype ever made in the United States. Draper got it from reading Daguerre's monograph, which had been published. Morse got it directly from Daguerre via Ampère. And the two combined to open up a commercial, the first commercial biotech, as it were, studio on top of New York University in Washington Square, where they charged for their plates and did experiments in another medium. One of the other things that Morse was doing at the time was he was working on the telegraph. And what this shows is Morse's 1840 patent. There's Samuel F.B. Morse. His student was Samuel Brady. But the reason he was able to transmit telegraphs over long distances was because the same Draper to whom I refer, John William Draper, the man who wrote the book about the conflict between religion and science, worked out the booster that made it possible to send the telegraph from Washington to Baltimore. And what did Samuel Morse put on the first message? What hath God wrought? Nonsense. What hath Draper wrought? Because if Draper hadn't given you the booster, it wouldn't have happened. People's faith may not be shaken, necessarily, by owning a computer or a telegraph, but it sure is shaken when they look at the bills of mortality. But if you take a look at longevity, and I draw the black line at the time that this conference was last held, Our Country, Our Culture, and you notice that longevity is going up. This, of course, is linear. Longevity is going up both for male and female, but the slope isn't as fast as the decline in the deaths. What's the conclusion? Our country is aging. And I would urge on you to show that our country is aging. I urge upon you the motto or the epitaph of Christopher Wren in St. Paul's. Si monumentum queris circumspice. If you look at the monument to the aging population, look around you. Now, the person who put the reason for this advance into words is a physician who is also not inconsiderable poet, William Carlos Williams, who I first heard reciting these just about the time that this symposium was first held. And from Patterson, the times are not heroic since then. He was talking about the classic age. But they are cleaner and freer of disease. Say it, no idea but in things. And in my remaining time, I'm going to give you the history of no ideas but in things that led to the Genome Project. It began with the Royal Society, the motto of which is Nullius in Verba. No ideas but in things comes from a statement by Horace. For the members of this society, having laid before their eyes so many fatal instances of the errors and falsehood of the past, have begun anew to correct all hypotheses by sense and by such outward instruments as are proper for their particular works. By this means, they find some reason to suspect that those phenomena confessed to be occult are performed by the small machines of nature. And the outward instruments is what I'm going to describe now. Nowadays, in the lab, the outward instruments of nature, by fluorescence in situ hybridization, also called FISH, one can now analyze chromosome breaks. And the new breakthrough in the curing of leukemia by Gleevec and David Baltimore's contribution to that can be monitored by FISH analysis of how our chromosomes are dispersed and rearranged. Moreover, we can tell which gene is up or down in any area of tissue. This is a microchip array of gene action, and you think I've done this to show you fish and chips, you're correct. The reductionist view was first foreseen by Diderot in D'Alembert's Dream. He said that you can distill life in a closed vessel. Eat, digest, distill in a closed vessel, and you'll have the whole art of making a man. Anyone who wants to describe to the academy the production of man or animal, you will need to make use of nothing but physical agencies. Well, a few years ago, or many years ago now, Alec Mangan and I worked out a structure called liposomes, which is an artificial cell membrane. These are now commercially available. In them, one can put DNA, enzymes to replicate DNA, and introduce genes by a process called lipofection and transform cells by this means. I think we were very happy when we found that we've been anteceded in this hypothesis by Denis Diderot. There's another Enlightenment scholar who predicted much of what we know about neurobiology. This was Jean-Georges Cabanis in the year 10 of the revolution, suggested le cerveau secrète la pensée comme la foi secrète la bile. The brain secretes thoughts like the liver secretes bile. The picture I show you is Broca's brain, and when those little red dots you see over there show the validation of this hypothesis. At the Max Planck, they showed what areas of the brain light up specifically when you do mimetic behavior, when you're trying to imitate some other facial expression. So this is thought being secreted by an active molecule. Is this generally accepted? Well, this is Eric Kandel's Nobel Prize in the year 2000, in which the brain secretes thought like the liver secretes bile, the secretion of synaptic vesicles is done by an exocytic process that is very much like the brain secreting bile. The Enlightenment was not wrong. This also applies to the latest of biological phenomena, the threat, for example, of anthrax. And little did you know that George Bernard Shaw had something to say on this. His Stimulating the Phagocyte in the Doctor's Dilemma was based on the work of Elie Metchnikoff, a reductionist microbiologist who was kicked out of his job in Odessa for three reasons. Number one, because of the Black Hundreds, he was out of favor since he was an atheist. He was also a Jew, and finally he was a Francophile. So he left for the Institut Pasteur and started studying the way that anthrax bacilli interacted with phagocytes. This is the first bacterium ever to be shown eaten by a phagocyte. And, of course, he pointed out that 37 degrees, the anthrax bacilli stimulate the phagocytes and are killed by them unless they kill the macrophages first. And, of course, that was picked up by George Bernard Shaw in another context entirely. For those of you worried about anthrax, take it easy. There's good news on the way. On this side of the Charles, over there, John Collier has worked out what anthrax toxin is. It was not known by the NIH until most recently, but we can stop this now. And the reason we can do this is because we know how it works. It turns out that there's a signaling cascade in phagocytic cells. And aspirin and anthrax work at exactly the same site, and there are drugs that can inhibit this. It turns out that that edema factor works at this site. Anthrax lethal factor works by cutting up, literally cutting to pieces, one of those molecules. And finally, aspirin in high doses inhibits that phenomenon. There are three drugs already on the market, which are now being developed, which are being taken for high blood pressure, for arthritis, and for infectious diseases, which have similar actions to block the effects of lethal toxin, and they're now being explored in experimental animals. This is reductionist science at its best, and it's based on the molecular knowledge of how bacteria work and how we work with them. Reductionism has had another simple fallout. Reductionism and impressionism arose in the same decade, in fact, almost the same year. Hippolyte Taine, a great a literary critic, and he wrote the History of English Literature in French in three volumes, was the first man to introduce the term reductionism. And he began his whole chapter on De l'intelligence, on reductionism, was since our ideas may be reduced to images, their laws may be reduced to laws of images, images then are what we must study. So he reduced these bites of information to images. 2 years, the book was published 2 years before Monet's Impression was first shown at the Impressionist show, which is then called the Impressionist show. Again, argument. Maya Shapiro disagrees with others as to who was the first one to coin the term, but at least this picture, everyone agrees, was called Impression. And this then had a major influence on how we look at the gene pool today. Helmholtz, who was one of the scientific inspirers of impressionistic color optics, also a few years before had invented the ophthalmoscope. When you go to the doctor, he looks in your eye grounds with the ophthalmoscope. That's based on the theory of absorption and emission of light, namely one spectrum going in, another spectrum going out, having to do with the molecular structure of what's inside. And this an expansion of this molecule has permitted us to make these microarrays and view them by fluorescent analysis, and it has also led to the work, love it or leave it, and I happen to love it, of Chuck Close. This sort of stimulation of the visual and the aesthetic by reductionist ideas has been fought tooth and nail by fans of natural law and fans of nature. Whereas the crystal structure of cyclooxygenase, as I said, may look like aesthetic structures, and its inhibition by aspirin may have saved many lives. There's still people who think that aspirin and drugs and pharmaceuticals and everything we know about the modern world is a disaster. Here's our old friend Norman Mailer. He's in despair. We're close to dead. There are faces and bodies like gorged maggots on the dance floor, on the highway, in the city, in the stadium. There are a host of chemical machines who swallow the product of chemical factories, aspirin, preservatives, stimulant, relaxant, and breathe out their chemical waste into a polluted air. The sense of a long last night over civilization is back again. Well, personal depression is a theme of much of modern art, but I would suggest that the pollutants that come out in the air and produce lung cancer can be solved by the resolution of modern chemistry. And here from the Genome Project working out of chromosome 3P, we've managed to isolate the tumor suppressor gene that is most frequently mutated in cases of lung cancer. This is a case of those machines and aspirin figuring out how we can try to save human lives rather than pollute Norman Mailer's psyche. Mollerschott, the man who said, Onifus vor keine Gedanken, said, gloomy ignorance, Unwissenheit, and worldly conceit, Weltverachtung, oppose every scientific hope and ideal. But conceit is based on despair, and gloom can be dispelled by light. That is why those who know only despair are wrong. Those who do not despair will continue their task, content to be rewarded by the knowledge of how things work. This has been accomplished not by spiritual thought, not by religious thought, but by sheer scientific reductionism, which William Carlos Williams would have adored, and which our hero, Denis Diderot, might have also exclaimed, that there is no difference at all between a doctor awake and a philosopher dreaming. Thank you.
Dr. Gerald Weissman speaking at this spring's conference, sponsored by the Partisan Review on Our Country, Our Culture, the Changing Role of Intellectuals, Artists, and Scientists in America, 1952 to 2002. Earlier this evening, we heard from inventor and entrepreneur Raymond Kurzweil. Next week, we'll have more from this portion of the conference, including remarks from Boston University professor James Collins and a general discussion among all three speakers and the audience. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Glenn Alexander and Tina Toby. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Have a pleasant evening.